Welcome to Book Club for Movies, everybody. It's August 23rd. I'm Ryan Miller, and I like cheesy things. I'm going to look for cheesy things. It's Matt Amber.
I do like cheese.
Do you? Because I feel like that's the least descriptive term for the movie we're actually going to watch this week.
I like cheese?
Or have watched. Talk about this week. You've already watched the movie, right?
I did, yes.
Okay, just want to make sure.
Yeah, I'm behind you. I'm with you on this.
On Book Club for Movies, where we watch one every week, we talk about it. Please join in. Send us your comments and or thoughts, and we'll bring them up just as quick as we can. This week, it is Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Matt, do you have a synopsis with which to delight our listeners and viewers alike?
No, I'm not sure.
Oh.
I do.
Well, okay. Do you have one that's just fine? Good enough?
We'll see how it goes.
All right.
Here we are. Here is your information and your synopsis. For Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, comes in an hour and 55 minutes. Written and directed by Martin McDonagh, starring Frances McDormand, Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell, and Caleb Landry Jones. Here is your Book Club for Movies, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri synopsis.
When a nearly year-long investigation into the rape and murder of Mildred Hayes' daughter has brought no arrests or new information, Mildred decides to challenge the local police by renting three abandoned billboards on the outskirts of... outskirts. They're a different kind of skirt.
Yeah, they're skirt shorts. No, girls wear them all the time, dude.
On the outskirts of town, targeting the chief, asking exactly why.
You want me to redo that?
Nope.
Because I can't. Three billboards. Martin McDonagh. Let's hit up him real quick. Please do
because just looking at what he's done, I don't think I've seen any of them, but I'm pretty sure you have and enjoy them quite a bit.
I have. The two movies that he is best known for are really the only two that he's kind of had come out, which are In Bruges.
Oh, I lied. I have seen one then.
And okay. Seven Psychopaths. And he wrote and directed both of those along with this movie. So he's the playwright auteur moving into film. I think watching those two movies and seeing where this movie comes from, very instructive. He has...
Actually, yeah. Just now that you've said In Bruges, it's been a while since I've seen it even. It just like seven things clicked and I don't know what they are yet. I guess we'll find out, but
everything about his sense of humor, the way he takes on drama, the way he adds action to things. And by action, I don't just mean like gunplay. I'm talking about, the physicality of a confrontation.
Right. Excellent way to put it.
And we get that, especially in, Ebbing, I think, but In Bruges also, you get so much of that between Gleason and Ferrell.
Very similar. Yeah, the way that movie unfolds too, actually, mm-hmm. Very parallel.
Yeah.
Making a lot of sense.
I think Martin McDonagh has a really good style, and I think out of the three, interestingly enough, I think Seven Psychopaths is kind of the one that is almost the redheaded stepchild, because you can see the DNA of him. You can feel it. Like, it reads, it sounds, it moves like a movie he made, but it's also further on the comedy side it's further on the black comedy side than either of these movies are. And while both In Bruges, and I think In Bruges definitely fits that dark comedy thing.
Oh yeah. All three of these.
And Ebbing definitely has its moments of,
oh yes,
of like pitch black comedy.
Sure.
And it works. Like, this is a movie where he knocks it out of the park, you know, I think so. In
so
terms
three
of
for
that,
three for you.
Yeah, in terms of his style, in terms of what he does and how he builds a narrative, yeah, he's three for three with me. Now let's get into the movie and see where it takes us.
Okay, mm-hmm. So you've done the synopsis. We know roughly. In fact, there's not a ton more to the story beyond what you've said. So, in fact, maybe the way to put this is that the movie begins with this character who has put up these signs to figure out why the police have not found the man who raped her daughter while she was dying, is what mm-hmm. the billboards say.
Yep.
And the first thing that comes to mind is that old saying that what happens when, and I don't know it and haven't looked it up, so this will be good. An unstoppable force meets an immovable object.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay. Either direction you can go with that.
Well, yeah. And he does, basically.
Yeah.
That's the first thing that comes to mind, because the character that Frances McDormand plays is very much that. Like, she is dogged. She is unwavering. The entire beginning of this film is a staccato masterpiece.
Great description.
Well, not only in how she plays that character, but also in how it's filmed.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, there's very little movement.
Okay. I think this is something that kind of is pervasive throughout the movie. And I don't know if you noticed it. And I would even have to go back and double check that I'm not crazy. But I think that's...
I mean, as a rule, yes,
but
go on.
Something that already you bring up, that the like lack of movement, there is a lot of that in this movie. There is a lot of people standing still. The other thing that I think is kind of fascinating, there are not a ton of people outside of the people we are directly involved with. You have people in the police station. You have the cops. You have the people in the office, the advert office, who rents out the things.
Right.
The streets are almost empty. Like, there's not a ton of traffic, people walking around, and it's supposed to be a small town. But I think one of the things that this points to is that this is a contained story, a contained situation that happened to these people.
Yeah. And I think where that whole unstoppable, immovable thing comes into contact more often than not is with the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be upfront with this. The story itself for the first half isn't particularly special or arresting. Like, visually, sure. It is definitely
great. It looks great. Great cinematography.
Yeah. Characteristically, definitely. Like, all the characters.
Yep.
But not, and we're going to spoil this real quick. The policeman that's kind of in opposition, Woody Harrelson, to Frances McDormand, is the one named in the billboards.
Chief Willoughby.
Yes. Has cancer.
Yeah.
And we see how that plays out with his family a little bit, and also at work, to the point where he's not the enemy. He's the opposition, but he's not the enemy. But he, almost exactly halfway through the film, shoots himself in the head rather than let himself slowly die and let his family deal with his slow death from cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And up until that moment, and I would say even including that moment, and this might just be me. It definitely is partly me and all the stuff that I watch or immerse myself in. Not particularly shocking or different or like I said, special.
Sure.
What are the characters that are created and portrayed. I mean, it's obvious that this is a character piece, you know,
mm-hmm.
but like basically setting up all those collisions for the first half of the movie,
right,
has one of the most brilliant payoffs of any movie.
Absolutely.
In that last half.
And I think that this is one of those films that, you know, we heard tons about how great Frances McDormand was. We heard lots about how amazing Sam Rockwell was. I don't know, man. I got to say, I think Woody Harrelson, he did everything he needed to do to make that character, like,
definitely
work. And one of the things that I think is great about it is that you're right. He's not the enemy. He's the opposition. And it's a fine line, right? Like, there is a fine line between being opposed and straight up being an enemy.
Right.
And she calls him out because who else do you call out, right? Like, you don't call out a deputy. Nobody cares about the deputy. Nobody cares about...
Well, the deputy here is Sam Rockwell, and too. And there's another reason why, but yeah, go ahead.
But you wouldn't... It wouldn't matter. You wouldn't call him out because he's not the one that actually can affect any change.
Right,
you call
out
the chief. And the way Harrelson plays it off at the beginning, before you know he has cancer, before he even, I think, really knows he has cancer.
No, I think he knows he has cancer the whole time.
Okay,
he doesn't mention it to Frances McDormand until there's a number of run-ins, obviously. I think that one was on their porch or something like that.
Yeah, and I think that he finally realizes how far along he is with the coughing up the blood. I think that's
yes,
the moment.
Yes.
Because, okay, so we're on the same. So
that's an amazing moment. Like, I don't want to gloss over that. But
no. We're not glossing.
Okay.
We'll get
don't
there.
Gloss.
I just wanted to point out that I think Woody Harrelson is tremendous in this movie, and he has in a number of films been okay. He's been very good in movies. I think he was excellent. He was a lot of fun in Seven Psychopaths. Great part of that movie. I totally understand why Martin McDonagh both cast him and then wrote the role for Sam Rockwell. Like,
right.
He straight up wrote it for him.
Because these roles were written for Frances McDormand, written for Sam Rockwell, written for Woody Harrelson.
And makes perfect sense.
Oh, yeah. They nail it. It might be harder to tell with Woody Harrelson is what it is. Like, I feel like I've seen this Woody Harrelson before. You're right. He does fantastic. He sells every inch of the character. But there are times where you're just like, he's Woody Harrelsoning.
I think, and this, you
I don't know.
I think what he does successfully is he gives the audience, I don't want to say like a respite because it's not that, but gives the audience kind of a breath where you're hammered by, in some ways, I guess maybe it's just kind of the way it's played off. You're hammered by everything that's going on with Frances McDormand. Like, this movie is not hidden about what it's about. And you're right.
No.
It's not super special in terms of the story. It's special in terms of how the characters are built to deal with it and how they're built to deal with each other.
Yes.
And I think that's something that Woody Harrelson's character does just a really good job of giving the audience a few moments of maybe she's taking it too far, maybe, and giving you a question. And I think by the end of the movie, I think the question is actually, and even before that, to a point, I think the question is kind of fully answered for most people. And I think most people, the answer is no, it's not too far. You didn't go too far.
Well, so we come into the movie through Frances McDormand. Like, she's the first person we see. She's obviously, I mean, she's maybe not obviously, but she's the protagonist. And she's the one who her daughter was raped, and she's putting up the signs. The police appear to have done nothing. So we're kind of immediately on her side anyways.
Right, right.
So Woody Harrelson maybe has an uphill battle, but the way both he gets that out there and the movie gets that out there is in these little moments with Frances McDormand where, and this is the first time I laughed out loud, where she proposes that DNA be taken from every male on Earth, you know, for the, and then when they commit a crime, you know about it because the DNA from the guy who killed her daughter didn't match anything, basically. But yeah, so Woody Harrelson does the perfect job of becoming that opposition. Like, and let's go to the coughing up blood moment.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty emblematic of what we're talking about here. It's the second or third time they come into contact, or she's actually committed a crime at this point, so he brought her into
the
station.
She drilled the right. So after the let's note this real quick. So after she puts up the signs, everybody in this tiny little town, of course, because it's a small town, loves the cops, loves the sheriff. The sheriff, and he's like the police chief, he's one of the boys. He's right. Friendly with everybody. She goes in for some dental procedure, and the dentist, in a not so oblique fashion, just straight up threatens her.
Has obviously sided with the police, like and I think it's said at some point that nobody likes the billboards, and her son kind of included,
right?
And so the dentist is very much on the police side. So he like doesn't give her Novocaine at first, et cetera. It's a really cool scene, but she ends up drilling through his finger. So they bring him or her into the thing, and he's questioning her, and kind of, again, it's a little bit more of the same, because the exclamation point here, the whole reason for the scene is when he accidentally coughs up blood on her because of his cancer, pancreatic cancer. And
a great moment.
Yeah, it's hard to even explain, because she has been set up again as this kind of immovable force, and the moment that blood hits her face and he's like, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. And the movie does this numerous times where you, and maybe it's just from other movies you've seen, I've seen, you feel like the movie's gonna explode.
Right.
Like that's the moment where she is just gonna go off on him or something like that. And he's like, I'm sorry, like that wasn't an insult. And it's because these scenes are so tense too, you know, they're played so well. But she's like, no, she immediately, you know, feels for him and gets
you,
it.
Okay, this is a moment where she is in that office and she is stone-faced and she is righteous about what she's done to the dentist, because she feels she's right because the dentist threatened her and this is her way of getting away.
She's denying it mostly, but yes.
But you can tell for her, she feels she's righteous about it. Like she is so cavalier about saying, no, I didn't do it. That's her.
She does not regret what she has done.
No, the moment it happens, this is just pure Frances McDormand. Like I give this to nobody else but her. She softens. Like, you can see it in her face.
It's crazy.
She goes from being the opposition to almost becoming motherly. Like, she softens up and immediately is, you need help.
So it's a great moment. It's the perfect moment for those two, because that's, and slowly we get more of this. That's where Woody Harrelson kind of, you realize, and it's maybe it is the small town thing too. Like, nobody's actually an enemy here. Everybody knows everybody too well.
Right.
You know? So yes, as an opposing force, Woody Harrelson is humanized. You know, he's not, also it's not that he's not trying to find the guy who did it.
Right.
He just couldn't, didn't know what else to do. Does pick up the case again when she starts making all this trouble. So he's definitely not the problem. And a lot of what he says after he dies emphasizes that. He leaves a bunch of letters for everybody, wherein he says also that the billboards, among other things, was a brilliant move. And pays for their rental for the next the following month is another cool
thing. Which he also mentions in there. He thinks it's kind of funny that she's getting beat up for it a little
right.
bit. Like he thinks it's kind of funny, so I'm gonna go ahead and leave it up. But he hopes that the thing, you know, gets caught.
Right.
And then before we continue with the letters, I think we need to jump back because one of the letters, the most important of the letters, I think, is the one to Sam Rockwell.
Which maybe we should set up Sam Rockwell a little bit more. We did roughly mention that he was kind of the deputy, but he's also we're introduced to him in that he may have tortured a black man that he did not refer to as a black man.
No, he did not.
Earlier in the movie, and he's like the worst kind of loose cannon. You know, he's not like a cool loose cannon, like, why can't the captain control him? Because he's got to solve crimes. No, he's like a bad loose cannon. Like, he keeps torturing people. He keeps stepping over the line. He's a bad cop, Matt.
Well, and he's...
Did you ever think about that?
I think one of the other things that they kind of hint at is that he's just not very bright.
Oh, no, he's not.
He's not...
Nope.
He is not outright... I don't think he is outright an idiot. I think that he is supposed to be a good example of what she is going up against.
And it's not like a Southern thing. Like,
no,
like a, like, you know, he's a hick
it's a
or
cop
something like
thing.
That. Yes.
No.
But yes, he's portrayed as a little bit lacking in many areas.
And this is kind of, you could say exacerbated or exclamation or an exclamation point that goes on it.
You could say exacerbated.
Is that he lives with his mother still. And he and his mother have a very clearly close relationship. What I thought was really interesting, by the way, about the mom. So as the movie progresses, Sam Rockwell talks with his mom here and there. They have like three or four scenes together where he says right at the beginning, his mom doesn't know about him torturing the guy because she wouldn't approve of it.
It's called person of color torture. This isn't a black comedy moment.
That's the, yes. He can't say the other word, so he's got to say person of color.
It's called person of color torture.
But he makes it sound to me like, and this is another one of those, maybe it's brilliant, maybe I'm reading into it, but he says his mom wouldn't like it. And his mom never at any point ever that I can remember says anything that's straight up racist. Now, she is not a good person because she absolutely promotes him trying to undermine anybody to do what he can to get his job back, stealing, killing, whatever he has to do. She is okay with that. But at no point does she propose or push that. Like, we never hear that kind of... Well, and I think it's interesting because it makes me wonder for that character... Where does that come from? Because you don't get it from Woody Harrelson's character. You don't really get it from anybody else. He's the bigot.
I mean, he's got, at one point, he's got some buddy cops around his desk that think he's pretty cool. After he throws the guy out the window. So he's definitely the one.
Thin blue line, dude.
On display, yeah. Well, the mother character, she's, everything she says, while not racist, is in the interest of her son. She's just the perfect mom character. Like, her son's always right. She will give, like, nothing's below the belt for her son, you know, all that. So, I mean, I don't know if she ever would have come out and said, oh, you shouldn't do that to her son.
Well,
she would have thought up some kind of justification for why he did person of color torture, you know?
Sure, I can see that. I guess it just comes back to that one specific line where he says she wouldn't approve of it. And maybe it's just the wording. Maybe that's it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But her mom, by the way, played by Max mom from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Great.
Oh, is that? Okay.
Yeah. Great moments with her and Sam Rockwell. But
I got to look this up. I think she might be the mom from Napoleon Dynamite too.
She was. Yeah, she was.
Okay.
she definitely was.
Almost the same character here. I've never seen her in It's Always Sunny, but she's like the evil version of the Napoleon Dynamite mom, maybe.
In Always Sunny, she's a chain smoker that barely talks, and she kind of just doesn't want to do anything and dislikes most people.
Hmm, okay.
She speaks mostly in grunts.
She's got a type, then, it seems.
Yeah, she's good. But let's get back to Sam Rockwell.
Sam Rockwell. So the movie does kind of revolve around him a lot. And a lot of the controversy, like I knew there was controversy surrounding this movie. I didn't know what it was about. Right. But a lot of the controversy with this movie, and we'll get to it, surrounds this character who is a bigot, who is a bad cop, who when Woody Harrelson's character kills himself, takes it all out on the guy across the street, which is the billboard company, by smashing the glass. This is a pretty great sequence too. It's all one shot from what I remember. The camera follows him and smashes the door. He goes upstairs.
Oh, him going into it. Yeah. Window.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a single shot.
Throws him out the window, in the which he rolls down the roof and lands like from a second story on the ground, and then goes back downstairs, kicks him in the face a couple more times. Basically, he's exacting revenge because he's angry because his boss, who he idolized, like he really, really idolized Woody Harrelson's character.
Absolutely correct wording there.
So he takes it out on that guy. Yeah. So you knew from the beginning he was going to be the source of, you know, real contention in this thing, because of his kind of decreased mental capacity, but also, you know,
he's aggressive. Like aggressive. Right away when you meet him, you say he's a bad cop. He's the bad cop in the
movie.
He's
a bad person. Yeah,
person in the movie. Sure. I would liken him to an uncontrolled dog, which is what Woody Harrelson was. He was the master of the dog, and he treats him like that. Like,
there you go.
He tells him, knock it off, get down, get back. Like, he's practically treating him like a dog.
Yeah, because, I don't want to say in a bad way though.
No. Like Woody Harrelson loves his dog, but it's still, he knows, and this comes out, we'll get to the why.
In a way, like if you wanted your dog to graduate to real personhood type thing, you know, like yeah, he had to be strict or tough love, maybe, I guess, but you always got and a lot of this came out in his letter that he gave to him, mm-hmm. which was a turning point. I feel like we're getting there pretty quick.
Yeah.
Wherein, yeah, he kind of expressed his love for him in that way.
Right.
For Sam Rockwell.
And we see the Sam Rockwell character become and stay aggressive throughout the whole movie for the most part. Even when we get to the way he wraps up, I still think that aggression is there. It's just now it's I won't say it's no longer as misplaced as it used to be.
Sure.
But we see him right away with that the advert character immediately. Like as soon as the billboards go up, Chief Willoughby and the Sam Rockwell character go to talk to him because they're literally across the street. And Willoughby has to continuously tell Rockwell's character to calm down, to leave it be, to back off, because he wants to beat the crap out of the guy who rented billboards. And I want to mention Caleb Landry Jones playing that character. Two movies now in 2017 where he was outstanding, this movie, and he was in Get Out, and he was fantastic in Get Out.
Okay. I still have to watch it.
Oh my goodness
gracious. Yeah, I know. I'm trying.
Okay. So we're with the Rockwell character at this point. So we kind of have, these are our three mains. You know, you've got Francis McDormand, Woody Harrelson, Sam Rockwell. Woody Harrelson kills himself, and then you get a letter, everybody gets a letter.
Yeah, I think we can just take this to the third act break, even, yeah. Like, which is basically Sam Rockwell's rebirth with that letter from Woody Harrelson's character. Chief Willoughby. And in the letter, basically gives him a roadmap. It's like, hey, these are your problems. And in a very loving way, like all of those letters are very impactful from the chief.
And I do want to mention again, I think that Woody Harrelson, they do a voiceover of him reading the letters. And yes, there are the letters that he reads. There are moments of joy, and there are other moments. And I think he does a great job reading those letters. Like, yeah, that was, it was, It was very impactful.
Sam Rockwell does a great job with his transformation, with his character's transformation here. Mm-hmm. And again, this is one of those moments where you think the movie's going to explode. You think Sam Rockwell's character is pretty irredeemable. Like, I feel like in movies like this, he doesn't come back. He just gets killed in the end or something like that.
Sure.
You know, maybe back in the day, maybe in the 70s or 80s, you know, Darth Vader was getting redeemed. But here he's... goes to the police station after he's been fired to pick up his letter from Willoughby. And while he's reading it with his headphones in, Francis McDormand has had enough. There's been another,
somebody burned the, they burned all of the billboards,
which she thought was Sam Rockwell. She was going to go burn the police station down. Didn't know anybody was in there, called several times to make sure nobody answered. Nobody answered because he was on his headphones. So while he's reading the letter, the building is being Molotov cocktailed to death by Frances McDormand from across the street, until finally she hits the window and the window explodes and he wakes up. So he's got this letter that's basically told him, you know, you're a good cop. You just need to do these things. You're a good person. You just need to do these things.
And
I know
and
you have it in you.
Willoughby, he, and this is important. He specifically calls out, you need to let go of the hate and the bigotry because yes. that's what's stopping you from being a good detective, which is yes. all Rockwell wants. Like Rockwell in so many ways is a kid that just wants to be a detective. I just want to catch the bad guys.
And idolizes, again, Chief Willoughby. Like all of yeah. those times where he is harsh with Rockwell, Rockwell does not retaliate. He does not, the dog analogy is becoming too apt. He doesn't, like your dog doesn't try and bite you back, you know? Like he's just like, oh, I'm sorry. He's just immediately sorry, like whatever I can do to get back into your good graces type thing, you know? Any dog I've had, which has been one so far in my life. So tell me if I'm wrong.
You're one for one.
Okay. And after that bottle explodes, again, this is the literal third act break. He grabs the Hayes case file off his desk for Frances McDormand's character's, Mildred Hayes, her daughter that got raped. And basically, I think the last word he says to himself is cop or be a cop. Or he mutters it something like, you know,
yeah, yeah.
Something like that to himself and jumps through the window on fire. And, you know, very subtly or not so, becomes that other character or starts the path to becoming this other character.
Fire purifying the prop.
Birth by fire. Birth, yeah, it's yeah. one of those.
And it is. It's totally a fire cleansing the evil from whatever, however you want to put it.
But in a cool twist, he becomes scarred from then on out where, I mean, if we were watching Mission Impossible, like he gets scarred at the end because he becomes evil, you know, like
he'd be wearing a mask. You'd take it off and you'd find out that he was, you know, he was the daughter and she never died. And this was all a thing to get her mom.
But immediately we get another moment where this movie was going to explode. He ends up in the same hospital room as the kid he threw off the roof, who doesn't recognize him at first. And then when he says he's sorry, and the kid recognizes who he is, has kind of an explosion, and then kind of disappears for a while, and you think, oh, he's coming back with a pillow or something, right?
Right, right. No, I was there. I was like, this is where
you think the movie's going to explode again. It's so good. He comes back with an orange juice and a straw and just kind of sits on his bed on the other side. Like, it's not relentless, but the seemingly relentless positivity of this movie is both surprising and arresting at just all the right moments.
It is a perfect example of and this is such a stupid analogy because it's used, in my opinion, in all the wrong ways. This is a movie that's an actual roller coaster. Like, yeah, it doesn't have it's not the exciting roller coaster, but it is. It takes you up. It drops you down. And every time you think you're going to hit the very peak, you're not quite there yet.
And maybe we should get there, I guess.
Yeah, let's finish this out. We got just a few more moments in the movie that need to be brought up.
So Sam Rockwell becomes the character that's trying to maybe a little more haphazardly. So, okay, let's get into the controversy too. Let's end it up with there. The controversy is that Sam Rockwell's character becomes redeemed or might have become redeemed, depending on how you read the film, and whether or not he deserved it. So what Sam Rockwell does is he goes to a bar, he gets drunk, and happens to hear a man that earlier went and harassed Frances McDormand about her daughter at her place of employment, this little trinket store. And he hears him, overhears him at a bar talking about how he raped a girl while she was on fire or fire was involved or something like that. So Sam Rockwell goes outside, gets his license plate, and then comes back inside and gets some DNA off the guy, which he then sends to get tested, but it comes back as...
By picking a fight, by the way. He doesn't just like... He doesn't walk up to him and accidentally pluck a hair like in the movies.
No.
No, he gets into a fist fight when he's already been burned and the crap has been kicked out of him.
I mean, fist fight, he doesn't throw any punches. He scrapes the guy in the face and then gets kicked and beat, you know, a bunch on top of his burnt skin. So at great physical risk does this to get the DNA that he sends in that comes back again as, and they use the same terminology as Chief Willoughby used initially, the new chief does, but basically in the same words tells him that the DNA matched nothing, nowhere, no how.
Right. Well, he says it can't be that guy because that guy was over a year ago or during the time he was a Marine or something. He was
out
overseas.
Of the country. Yes. Yeah. But it's classified and he can't tell him exactly. So, I mean, the movie doesn't tell you that he was the guy that raped her. I think it was. Otherwise, why would they have that scene before where he came in to harass her in the store? You know?
Sure.
I'm pretty positive that guy was the guy that raped the daughter, even though, and the fact that they talk about it coming back classified, like there was some amount of cover up going on and that's why type thing, you know?
Sure.
It's not important to the story really, but if you want an answer, I'm pretty sure that was it. But so we get at the end, at the very end, in fact, I got scared for a second because it's Sam Rockwell calling Frances McDormand and they have a great moment where they connect, you know, another small moment, another thing where seemingly everything is forgiven, but really just what things really are is laid bare, and tells her about this guy and then, you know, goes and get his gun after the DNA comes back negative and is like, hey, he lives in Idaho. And she's like, oh, that's funny. I'm going to Idaho tomorrow. You want to come? And he's like, yeah. So he gets his gun. And that next morning, they're driving to Idaho. And there's a wide shot where they're kind of driving off into the sunset. It's not the sunset, but they're disappearing as they drive past the billboards. And I thought, oh, man, like I could see somebody ending the movie there, but I wasn't quite ready. I was like, shoot, like I know. Okay. But then there's one more scene where they talk to each other and it did everything I wanted it to. And that's where it ends. Like her last line is like, well, we can decide on the way. We'll see.
We can decide on the way.
Yeah.
What they're going to do.
All it needed for me. And that's where the movie ends. So add what you want to add, good sir. But I think our final question is, did he deserve redemption? Was he redeemed? Two-part question.
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting question. Was he redeemed? I would personally say no. I don't think he's redeemed. I think that he has, as a character, he has a ways to go. I think that at the end, it's not redemption for him yet. I think it's the path to redemption. Where he goes from there is up to him. And I think that you get a little bit of maybe I'll even give him a step further down the path to redemption with that last bit, because I do think it makes a huge difference, but I don't think he's redeemed.
I agree. Actually
to take away just the last thing he does like that. And I'm not talking about the fight. I'm talking about throwing the dude out the window and getting an apology. Getting, just because you got an apology and you made an apology and you were forgiven doesn't mean you're redeemed. You know, you still were the person that did that. You got to do more to redeem.
And the kid
goes
and sits on his bed away from him. Like he's not over it, you know, like,
right.
Nothing is wrapped up as quickly as it seems. I see why that might be the problem, you know, where like, oh, everything's okay. That impression is ever given.
No.
I might take issue with the speed at which Rockwell kind of mentally makes the leap.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's covered in the movie because he does idolize Willoughby so much and because Willoughby is so... I mean, the movie itself is incredibly well-written, but Willoughby's words are well-written to him. I could see how, you know, somebody very important in your life sits you down, especially after dying, and says, hey, this, like, that has an impact on somebody.
Sure.
Like, in and outside of movies.
No, so, I absolutely agree. I think, but I don't think at the end of this movie he is redeemed yet. Give me three billboards outside of, you know, Dakota, Idaho.
Somewhere Idaho, yeah.
And sure, but I don't think that question really, to me, is all that important. Like,
no, because I think the answer is like what we've said. Like, if it was, yeah, if they went to greater pains, or maybe they could have given more half steps. like right after he jumped out of the window and I realized he was going in the other direction, mm-hmm. I was like, okay, I'm going to need some missteps still. Like, sure, Sam Rockwell can't hit it all out of the park from here on out as a good guy. He's going to need to do some things badly or stupidly while he's trying to become a new person. Maybe they didn't give us enough of those. Okay.
And you could definitely argue that him doing things outside of the law in terms of trying to do the right thing, scratching it, you know, I mean, you're physically assaulting a private citizen. You know, that's, it doesn't, and you're an ex-cop on top of that with a history of doing this. Not a great decision. And then on top of that, it's the, we're going to grab a gun and we're going to go to Idaho.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
You know, maybe not the best decisions, but again, you go back to the whole situation at the beginning of why this is all happening in the first place. Okay. Maybe I get it. Like,
yeah,
because one of the things that we've mentioned this multiple times that Rockwell's character idolized Chief Willoughby. The one thing Willoughby couldn't do in his life was solve this murder. And so I think that for the Rockwell character, redemption comes when that's kind of, when that story, when that part of his life is concluded, and it's concluded in a better way. We don't see that, so we don't know.
But I'm perfectly happy with the ending of that film. 100%.
Great ending. Great beginning. You know,
middle.
Good. You know, those like quarter bits.
Pretty good.
Wow.
Man, like total, if I added like every segment together,
yeah,
it adds up to 533 stars
out of 532. So wow,
like there's a problem with the math. That's just Book Club for Movies, but it's a good film.
That is a good film. That, everybody, was Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. Little bit of information. Next week, we will not have a Book Club for Movie selection because Ryan and I will be out. We'll be doing things. You can watch us on Twitch.tv/ZeroHitPoints on Friday evening when we are at PAX, the Penny Arcade Expo, because our other podcast, Zero Hit Points, go check that out, ZeroHitPoints.com, is a video game podcast. So we're going to go and hang out. It's like the one time of year Ryan and I get to actually see each other and sit in the same room, and mm-hmm. I get to frustrate him by poking at him and touching him occasionally while he's trying to cast.
And then we start the podcast.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And as much as I like the idea of us doing a movie podcast at the video game expo, I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't think it's going to happen either.
But I'm sure we'll mention one or two. So tune in either way.
Tune in. Zero Hit Points on the Twitch TV.
What movie should they watch? They've got 2 weeks to watch it now.
They do. I have two suggestions for you. I'm going to
throw these live.
Throw these up into the air. Yes, live. One, because I had no idea you hadn't seen it. And two, because I don't know.
I mentioned one too to you earlier. Is the one I mentioned to you one of the ones you'll mention to me?
I don't know.
Okay, so there will be three. Let's see. Which one do we choose? Go, Matt.
Get Out.
Oh.
No, just Get Out.
Aha.
Yeah, no. Get Out or The Last Starfighter. See, I'm on different. Wow,
that's a real Sophie's choice you got there.
It's a really similar situation. Like, good movies.
Isle of Dogs was the one I mentioned.
Ooh! Oh, that's murderous. I see. you can't throw Wes Anderson at me and think I'm not gonna say yes to that. Of course.
Oh, I mean, you throw Get Out at me. I wanted to see that real bad.
All right. Yeah, let's do this.
How badly can we do a Get Out podcast? Is my other question.
We're gonna do Get Out first. I think. Okay. I think we're gonna do Get Out first. We're gonna do Isle of Dogs afterwards, because after Get Out, we're probably going. This is gonna be great. Actually, I'm telling everybody this ahead of time. Get Out. Lots of really wonderful themes. The racial tension obviously being a huge theme. Same themes occurred in Isle of Dogs, and there was lots of controversy around how that worked.
You have seen Isle of Dogs, or
I have not seen it.
Okay,
yet.
Gotcha.
So that's why I'm interested to see if we get any parallels between maybe not purposeful themes, but purposeful in one movie.
Okay, all right. It's going to be a rough couple weeks. I know for Get Out, I'm probably also going to watch actually Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. I have that.
Oh, sure.
And for Isle of Dogs, I think it's just going to open up a whole
Homeward
Wes
Bound.
Anderson can of worms. Yeah, oh. that's the one.
I don't know.
So whatever. It's Book Club for Movies. Check us out. Don't forget us or the rest of the show.
Yeah, let's do that.
Do you have any other movies you want to talk about this week?
I got one movie I want to talk about here. I'm going to bring this one up. It's a top tier for me. This one, Beyond the Black Rainbow, comes in an hour and 50 minutes, written and directed by Panos Cosmatos.
Good director.
Panos Cosmatos.
Oh, that's better.
Panos Cosmatos. Starring Eva Braun. Eva Braun.
What? Are you kidding?
We're going to do this all one more time. I'm going to nail it this time.
Where was she this whole time?
Okay. Third time's a charm, everybody.
I don't know if you're going to top any of the other ones.
Beyond the Black Rainbow, an hour and 50 minutes, directed, written by Panos Cosmatos. Starring Ava Bourne, Michael Rogers, and Scott Islands. This is a movie that I came into hearing about sometime in the mid 2010, I guess not 2010, it'd be closer to 2012, 2013.
I've heard of these years.
And I didn't know anything about it other than I'd heard that it was a weird movie that came out of Canada and then it just didn't go anywhere. Like I didn't hear anything about it for a long time. And then it showed up at some point on Blu-ray and I don't know that it ever made it to a theater. So Panos Cosmatos is a very interesting guy. He is also the writer and director of the upcoming Nick Cage movie, Mandy. If you have seen the trailer for that, you already know the insanity here. Beyond the Black Rainbow is I would say in every respect, it is an art film that is a very well done, arty, weird take on a sci-fi horror story where describing this movie is very difficult because it is in so many ways indescribable. The general kind of shell of this movie is that there is an institute that was created in the 60s by a guy who was trying to bridge the gap between science and spiritualism. And the character, by the way, one of my favorite names maybe ever, his name is Dr. Mercurio Arborio. Just a great name, Mercurio Arborio.
Is the director coming up with all the
oh yeah, he wrote this.
The character names. He's like, I've got a few normal names here you might recognize.
Panos Cosmatos said. So this guy created this institute, and his protege has built a hospital like a underneath it that has he's found a girl who has a form of like psychic power, and he has figured out a way to nullify the psychic power, and he's trying to figure something out about her. You're not really let in on why that when he talks to her as a doctor, it's more like it's more of an interrogation where he's using this ability to break her down. And the only thing that she says to him is through telekinesis or through telepathy that she's saying, I want to see my dad. And he keeps saying, you can't see your dad, but maybe you can see your mom. And maybe there's a picture of your mom and your mom was beautiful and this and that. And it goes down these weird rabbit holes of what he's doing. He's taking all these weird pharmaceutical drugs that are that give off. I don't remember if they actually say it or not, but you get the impression that they're psychedelics. And he goes home and he has a wife that's very servile and is not like
Prozac.
No, but kind of.
Okay.
And the thing that gets this movie that kind of gets this movie going for me is not only the fact that I love, give me a slow burn horror movie. Like I love them. You know, I do. Give me that like last bit at the end where things just go off like left field and things are, yeah, I love
sure,
it.
Sure, sure, sure.
This is a slow burn. It's 2 hours long practically. And it is filled with color. Like he uses color in a crazy, crazy way. It is got an 80s look to it, very specific 80s look. The grain of the film looks like an 80s look. All of the kind of retro futurism that they use The movie takes place in 1983. He did a really good job of set design where you have this, like I said, retro futurism, but from the 80s. And okay. it very much looks like stuff from the 80s. Even amazing. Like the guy's hair, like that he wears, the way it's worn, just 80s. The outfit's 80s. It like, and this is pre Stranger Things. This is pre all of like the revival of that stuff. And it's a great movie. It is a hard movie for a lot of people because there are lots of, like, he'll do a long shot of the guy's face and then there'll be a number of super fast cuts of like bright color and maybe her face and then like an orange just splash and then it kind of dissolves into black back to him. And it does lots of that.
Okay.
And I think from a film school perspective, I think this would probably be a really interesting movie for somebody to, especially when it comes to editing and cinematography in particular, lighting. Sure. This is a movie I think that would be probably a good movie to be talked about in that respect.
Yeah, movies like that often show up having been made by students or shared by teachers. So yes,
sure. And this is a movie. here's some fun, fun factoid about this movie, I suppose. They have the movie was supposedly financed by residuals from his father's final movie, which his father, according to kind of the grand gossip world around this,
okay,
didn't really direct the movie because Kurt Russell actually kind of directed it. His father, George P. Cosmatos, directed, quote-unquote, Tombstone.
Oh.
And Tombstone knowingly had issues with the first director. They booted him off completely, and Kurt Russell directed all the stuff he did. And then Cosmatos was brought into it, and the understanding that I've always had is that he definitely did stuff, but Kurt Russell really directed the majority of that movie.
I'm so annoyed that you uttered the word of Tombstone.
Because as soon as you hear it, you want to watch it.
Yep.
Yeah, it's great. So his dad directed that, and the film was financed. And it doesn't look like this movie, like this movie has a beautiful look to it in a minimalist, retro future, sci-fi way. And I love it. It's great.
Cool.
And then on top of this, the last thing I'll mention about this movie, Sonoyewa Caves did the soundtrack for this, and I bought that on vinyl. I have it on MP3. That soundtrack is outrageously great.
Cool.
It is everything you can think of from an 80s style. It's that, you know, Stranger Things brought back that kind of synth stuff that
I was saying. New music though, not like
totally
like,
new music. Uh-huh. It's all created for the movie. It was
some Flock of Seagulls in there.
It's lots of electronic stuff. Yeah, Flock
Wedding
of Seagulls.
Singer, just uh-huh. songs from the Wedding Singer.
Yep,
yeah.
Yep. Lots of Culture Club in there.
Adam Sandler literally singing. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Beyond the Black Rainbow. Check it out. What do you got?
Another. I guess we'll talk about two art house films this time. I did some more catch up from another movie you had to mention, so I had to watch it. The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Yeah. Oh, did you watch you watched the actual movie?
Yes, the Henry Cavill, because we got to talking about
Napoleon Solo.
Mission Impossible.
And Ilya, I can't remember what Ilya's last name is. It's like
me
Ilya,
neither.
Ilya Gregorovich or something like
the
that.
The Russian dude.
Yeah,
that explains why his Russian accent's so good. Guy's actually Russian, huh?
Ilya, I don't know.
Movie,
the guy who played Ilya was Armie Hammer
from what? No way!
Freaking Facebook.
Is that him from Facebook? I only know him from Lone Ranger. Is that seriously him?
Yeah.
Okay. It does a good Russian accent. Turns out that movie is surprising in a number of ways. It is a Guy Ritchie film.
Definitely.
But it's not, that might be a bad way to start.
It's reserved.
It's an outlier. Oh man, it's so reserved. Like it is not, there are some moments in there where you can tell he's kind of putting his signature on it. Like they're not technically smash cuts. They're like smash interludes type things where you're like, okay, Guy Ritchie's like, gotta do some of these. But in general, very reserved for a Guy Ritchie movie. I don't have any knowledge about the source material. So I don't know. The movie is about this kind of reformed criminal, Henry Cavill, who's become a CIA or FBI agent. Is this CIA?
CIA. Yeah.
Spy. Intelligence operative. And is forced to team up with a Russian, basically his Russian counterpart, and Alicia Vikander, who's an American, isn't she? No, German. She's German. I'm sorry.
In real life or in the movie?
Oh, in real life. No, I want to say she's Swedish or something like that.
Yeah, she's Swedish in real life.
But no, she plays a German in this film.
Yes.
So basically that threesome is taxed with taking down a nuke, or what they don't know. They find out if the uranium's been enriched and stuff like that. But her father is the scientist, so she's connected in that way. So they go and get her, and it's about, you know, going to Italy and these different spots to meet different people. And it's a spy movie at that point. But I think what it does, speaking of good soundtracks, actually, the soundtrack is super fun. It's all licensed music, but it's really, really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it melds so well with the style. The style is done just freaking perfectly. Like, it's 70s, 60s, everywhere in between. It's probably just one time period. I don't know very well.
I'm guessing they went with the 60s because the movie takes place. It should, I don't remember the exact year, but I think it takes place in like 67 or something.
That would be my guess. Like early 70s at the latest, but it's very, yes, it's 60s. You're right. So all the costumes are real great. The style is real great. It melds with the, you know, spy aesthetic really well.
Mm-hmm.
Cavill is kind of Cavill. I don't know if he's doing anything revelatory here. It's fun to see him not be Superman.
I like him. I just like the guy.
I do like him. That's very strange. I don't know if he's earned that yet, but he's...
I am totally with you. I don't know why. He's just one of those... I actually, you know what? I think I do...
I like how we're attracted to big, sexy men, and we don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, I know why I'm attracted to, say, a Christian Bale. You know, I want him to yell at me. But no, Henry Cavill, I think what I like about Henry Cavill is, and I've mentioned this before, he is in so many ways, he came off and he comes off to me very much like Christopher Reeve. Like, he just seems kind of Superman-y. Like, he seems kind of Clark Kent-y, that he just is a nice guy. And maybe he's not.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Who knows? We'll find out sooner or later.
It'll come out.
Maybe recently. But I think what the film does that's super bizarre, besides being restrained for a Guy Ritchie film, and it's not the best Guy Ritchie or even the best film. It's fun. It's totally fun.
Yeah.
Whether or not you have fun with it might be a little taxing at times. There are two very enjoyable aspects to it. One of them's in my head, and I feel like the movie kind of toys with the idea of what if James Bond is kind of not a real interesting character, because this is a James Bond-ish type thing that they're doing here. Henry Cavill is that. In fact, you could see Henry Cavill as James Bond. Probably.
Definitely. I definitely could see Henry Cavill do I don't know that he'd be good, but I could see it.
Yeah, no, he wouldn't be great, but hey. But the romantic interest is given to the Russian agent. Mm-hmm. Like, all of the depth in the film is given to Armie Hammer, I guess, his character.
It's Ilya. It begins with a K. Ilya Kurykin.
But it works, too. I like his character. I like the emotional arc he's given. He has daddy issues. And he's given the love interest. Like, him and Alicia Vikander, their romanticism is pretty fun to watch on screen. And I think it's interesting because Cavill is still pretty much the center of this film. Like, he's definitely the one talked up. And maybe I'm looking at contracts here made lifelike. But he is the movie. And at the same time, nothing really interesting happens with him. He portrays his character cool, and he is a James Bond character, but his character doesn't really progress in any way. You know, it's all given to Alicia Vikander and Armie Hammer.
So in many respects, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was kind of a response from the U.S. to the Avengers.
What? Really?
Yeah. They hated Captain America at the time, and the Hulk was barely there. So it was just not, they weren't a big fan. So they were like, yeah, let's a couple humans. And see what happens as spies. No, the Avengers, the TV show, Emma Peel and John Steed.
Oh, you're talking about the freaking, okay.
They're
right.
Called the original, the actual Avengers.
Yes.
John
Who
Steed.
Who was in that movie? They
John
did a
Steed
movie
and Emma
remake
Peel.
Of that too.
They did a terrible remake of it with Ralph Fiennes, Uma Thurman, and Sean Connery.
That's right.
Sean Connery played August de Winter. The entire plot of the movie was him stealing the weather.
Not knowing anything. That makes sense. Yeah, I get that. No,
so,
you know.
So Man from U.N.C.L.E. was in a lot of ways a response to that, and it was also a response to James Bond. There are a number of stories that have floated around in, like, Flynn, great takeoff of the James Bond character, the Americanized version, who's a little dumber but is also very like, ha ha ha, I can get any woman, and he can't, but he kind of does. Yeah, the Avengers.
A lot of this going around. You're talking about Get Smart too. You're talking about
And if you look at the time period, like that they were all at the same time. You know, yeah. It was 1963, 1964 when these were coming out.
I think this is a fun. Yes, this is a fun one of those. It's cool to look back in a bunch of ways while watching this thing. I think it's interesting the construction that they've given it.
Yeah.
Two other things I think are super fun. Guy Ritchie does this thing in his movies where it's kind of dialogue across scenes. You've got different things happening intercut with different conversations happening.
I love that
form into one conversation that is, you can follow and advances the story in just the most bizarre. Like, he does this in a bunch of his movies, but it's,
yep.
It's his thing, and he's freaking great at it. And there's another couple of those in here that are fun to watch.
I will never, ever stop loving Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Still my favorite.
I think the second thing that's funny about this movie is that it's the third one I can think of, so there's probably more, where it ends basically with a setup for a sequel
that
he'll probably never get to make.
Nope, never happening.
Rock and Rolla, same thing, ends with a total complete setup that I want to see.
Just makes me mad. So mad.
He did it with King Arthur too, which we talked about and I actually liked, despite what you might have heard or seen. Like, the trailer doesn't show real well for that, but does the same thing. That sequel's probably not going to happen. Does it with this thing. I can't imagine. I don't know
if the next going to happen. Next movie Guy Ritchie is making, to my memory, that is signed, is he's making another Sherlock Holmes movie.
That would be the one that's not set up for a sequel that he gets to do. Or maybe it is.
Well,
there's two ways they set up a sequel. There's one where it's kind of like a wink and a nod where they're like, the show goes on no matter what. Like, I like when movies end like that. None of his are doing that. His are doing movies that are like, there's going to be a sequel. Like, they set up a new mission and it's, yeah.
Not Sherlock Holmes is easy to bring back, though.
Yeah, and that's Robert Downey Jr. at this point. That's all you got to say. Anybody will make that movie.
Yeah.
But that's all I got. That's all we got.
That's all we got. All right. Well, let's stop talking about it.
Okay. Book Club for Movies. We have a website and a Facebook and a Twitter. You can contact us on all of those. And we'll talk about all of those contacts when we talk next week.
Yeah. Don't forget.
Sorry. In 2 weeks.
Don't forget, swing by twitch.tv/zerohitpoints on Friday evening, Saturday evening, Sunday evening, possibly Monday evening. We'll see what happens. Anything
possibly.
Is possible.
That one's always a wild card. Who knows?
Yeah, that is definitely a wild card. We don't know, but we will definitely have some content out there for Penny Arcade Expo PAX up in Seattle. Hey, if you're in Seattle and you're listening, let us know if you want to hang out. We'll be there. You come down to PAX.
Yeah. I got movies for a bit.
I got a Friday pass. You can buy that off me for face value.
The Friday is the one you have remaining, huh?
Friday is it?
Wow, I feel like that's a hot seller too.
I think I got Sunday and Monday sold. Friday is available. One
All
ticket.
Right. Friday's available. Friday, I'm in love, you could say, Matt.
Don't ever say that. I hate that band a lot. The dying leaves are dancing off of the trees. They got an easy way. Let you and me go dancing too. Record dancing shoes. Hey.